Everyone brave is forgiven, examines love, loss, and courage. Set in 1939, it focuses on the intertwining lives of Mary, Alistair, and Tom as they navigate a brutal war. Chris Cleave is the author. He's a British journalist and writer. Everyone Brave is Forgiven is his fourth novel and brings him to the Margaret Mitchell House here in Atlanta tonight. I spoke with him in advance of his appearance. In the opening of Everything Brave is Forgiven, we read that London is a city in love with beginnings. In fact, this beginning refers to the day in 1939 when war is declared, and London as well as love are key elements in this story. The first character we meet is Mary North. How would you describe Mary?
I would describe Mary as a person, the kind of person who used to be my worst nightmare. She's aristocratic, high-born, and has this huge sense of entitlement. She's very funny, but boy, does she get on your nerves. And at the beginning of the book, we see her in a completely unreformed state, excited about the war, thinking it's going to be quite a jolly for her and her very privileged group of friends. But then real life happens to her. The war is much more intense and much more engaging for her than she had ever imagined. And slowly it chips away at these class structures with which she surrounded herself until we actually find the real person underneath it, and we find that she is braver and stronger and infinitely more likable than we might have guessed at the beginning. Mm.
She imagines the glamour of espionage after she hears war declared, but her assignment is quite different. She's assigned to teach elementary school-age children.
And at first, she's distraught about that. She can't imagine anything worse. And yet, when she begins to teach, she discovers, as so many people do who have that vocation, that she can't think of anywhere that it would be more worthwhile to be than in that classroom. It really changes her.
Yes, she's so drawn into teaching. And she says the only difference between children and adults was that children were prepared to put twice the energy into the product of not being sad.
Well, that's what I like about teaching, and that's what I like about kids. They are prepared to put twice as much effort into this project of not being sad. They're unbelievably cheerful and motivated creatures, and I think that energy helps her to see herself in a different way.
Mary is especially fond of a little boy named Zachary. What is his situation?
Well, Zachary is one of the many children who weren't evacuated from London at the beginning of hostilities. So I should probably fill in a bit of detail. London in 1939 was a city on the brink of war, and they expected imminent aerial bombardment from Germany. So what they did was they organised a pretty efficient and orderly evacuation of all of the children from London. And that went quite well. About 80% of the children were evacuated, but a lot of the children came back. Now, these were children who were not well looked after sometimes in the countryside, and these tended to be people that the countryside was less willing to accept. These were, in many cases, disabled people and people from ethnic minorities. And a lot of them came back to the city. And so Zachary was one of the children of Britain's 10,000 black families who were living in London at the outbreak of war. And they suffered a depth of hostility, a depth of racism that was absolutely horrific. And Zachary suffers from this and becomes an emotional casualty of the war, even before the bombing starts. He's returned from his evacuation village to London and finds himself under the tutelage of Mary, whose class he's in. and they form a bond. They like each other.
In fact, the introduction of Zachary, his father, and the minstrel show exposes us to the unashamed racism in England at the time. Many of the characters use the N-word throughout the book, and it's terribly disturbing to read. I think this may come as something of a shock. I don't know that Americans were aware of the extent of racism in Britain.
Yes, I was really shocked by it too. I think you put it very well when you used the word unashamed. You know, I think they were unashamed, unabashed, and really it was unacknowledged as well. I think people didn't even have a concept of how racist the society was. I found when I was researching, for example, instances of black families who had been kicked out of air raid shelters in London during active air raids because the Londoners just didn't like the idea of sharing that space with them. So that's a very concrete example of a racism that goes beyond antipathy, that goes beyond name-calling into something that's, you know, physically a violent assault on the person. And this was normal. Mm. You know, we have, thank God, made some progress since then. But I thought it was important to show what that society was like, to show that in a time where we were fighting evil, where we were looking to build an alliance around anti-fascist values, there were still these deep divisions in our own society. And the reason that I write about this and the reason I think it's important to show the roots of where we're coming from is because these problems haven't stopped. They haven't gone away. And I think it's important to trace their progress through history so that we can better address them now.
The other main characters are Tom Shaw and Alistair Heath, their friends, who also share an apartment. Tom, we learn, noticed things that made one melancholy. He does not enlist. Alistair restores paintings at the Tate Gallery as his profession. He is motivated to enlist immediately. Please tell us more about these men and the difference in their wartime experiences.
Well, Alistair is a great one to start with. As you say, he's a curator at the Tate Gallery, which is where Britain houses its most treasured works of art, its most treasured paintings by British painters. And an amazing thing happened at the beginning of the war. Even before they'd finished evacuating the children, they evacuated all of the paintings from the Tate Gallery. They put them into trucks and they took them to Wales, which they thought wouldn't be bombed. And they hid them underground in coal mines with instructions for how they should be reassembled if society was ever to come right again. Now, these were incredibly treasured artifacts. And of course, that left the Tate Gallery empty. So Alistair, as a character, is someone who finds himself suddenly in charge of nothing, of an empty gallery, and he thinks it would be churlish of him if he didn't then enlist and try to bring about a speedier end to the war. So he is classically brave right from the beginning of the book. In contrast with his best friend Tom, who thinks that the war is all a political nonsense, that it will never actually begin, and that it's a joker's game to enlist. And gosh, it turns out that Alistair was right and Tom was wrong. Mm. And they both have to live with the consequences of that decision.
Well, London itself functions as a main character, and I was hoping you would read that passage, beginning with London closed.
Oh, right, yes, and this is Mary, when she is walking through her city in typical London rain. She says, well, here was what she wanted to know. Now that she had left the cafe and London closed around her with its smell of coal smoke and lorry exhaust and tube ventings and railway grease and frying and horse droppings and wet masonry and exhaled cigarettes and damp worsted overcoats, and quick brown water coursing in the gutters and slow brown water infusing with disintegrating newsprint in the puddles, along with the butts of everything that had already been smoked, an anarchic and listing flotilla. Here was what she wanted to know. As the clouds made the day dark and she pulled her Macintosh tight and crossed Chalk Farm Road between the cars with their slotted headlights that made them look as if they'd just arisen after a heavy night and were fumbling for the tin of aspirin, here was what she wanted to know. Was one meant to feel certain about love?
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with the author Chris Cleave about his novel, Everyone Brave is Forgiven. He'll be at the Margaret Mitchell House tonight. You're listening to City Lights. I'm Lois Reitzes. Let's dive back in. Alistair's brief visit to London when he's on leave is a turning point in the story as well as in his character. Is he breaking down?
Yes, I think that's a really good reading of it. What happens to Alistair is something that we would recognise now as post-traumatic shock, but which wasn't really acknowledged at the time. Alistair doesn't have this very severe form, which I guess at the time might have been called shell shock.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, what he does have are these unexplained confusions and impulses and times when he's not cognitively in control. And this is very atypical of him, and he can't get his head around it. And he therefore tends to ascribe all of that dysfunction to the almost equivalent level of disintegration and degradation of London as the bombardment that we call the Blitz progresses. And so you see the two of them heading down very steeply towards some kind of nadir in lockstep together, he and the city that he grew up in.
Your maternal grandfather served in Malta. Would you take us to Malta now and please tell us about Simonson?
Yes, of course. So Malta was besieged during World War II from June 1940 to November 1942. It was incredibly strategic. Everyone wanted a piece of it. And so the British had garrisoned it, and the Germans and Italians had encircled it and were trying to stop supplies getting through to it. So it became a crucible. It became the most heavily bombed place on Earth. It was hell on Earth. There was no food. The whole garrison began to starve. And in that context, people were ground down until you really saw their basic nature. You know, it separated people into the strong and the weak. And on that island, Alistair encounters a fellow officer, a brother officer called Simonson. And the war will test them both equally, and it will only find one of them strong enough to resist the moral degradation that kind of physical and mental punishment wreaks on a person over a period of months and years. And I guess I shouldn't spoil it by saying which of them.
No, but their repartee is very amusing. And, of course, Simonson is aristocratic. How much of your grandfather is in him?
Well, Alistair's the character that I've based on my maternal grandfather. So Simonson is higher born than my family, as was Mary in the book. So I'm a very ordinary sort of Londoner. You know, I figure I'm roughly in the middle. And that is a good place to come at a novel from, you know, because life in Britain then as now was largely defined by accidents of birth. You know, we still have this huge problem with an entrenched class system. And I think that it's very interesting to come, I hope, from a neutral position to examine that and to say, right, you know, these are people's predetermined lives in London in 1939. This is the course they were set on. And here comes this huge disruptor, which is World War II. And it's going to shake everything up. It's going to break all of the rules, and it is going to become, for a brief period, more important that you show strength of character than you acknowledge your privileges of birth. These are really interesting lenses through which to look at a society.
Yeah.
And I know it was the same in America. I mean, I've toured all over America with this book, and people are amazing at book events. They come and they tell you their family stories. And everyone has a family story that has come down to them from World War II. And you see that it was a huge disruption in America's social system too. And it's very fascinating for me as a writer to come and visit and learn about these enormous changes to society that could not have been brought about, some of them very positive changes, without this very terrible cataclysm.
Yes, in fact, Alistair says, I'll bet you England is different after the war, kinder. Alistair hopes that one's class will matter less and one's convictions more. Do you think the war actually broke those barriers in Britain?
Yes and no. So after the war, one extraordinary thing that happened was that all of the women who had been left essentially to run the country, everything administrative, everything functional, everything to do with keeping the factories going, everything to do with keeping the schools going, they had proven a competence to do that that they had never before been given the chance to do. And after the war, they jolly well weren't just going to hand those jobs back and get back to being happy homemakers, right? So it was the start of a second big wave of feminism in Britain. That changed everything. That had huge social consequences and was really constructive. Another thing that happened all for the good was that in 1948, we had a Labour government who created something that we called the National Health Service, which was socialised medicine, free at the point of need. That enormously changed things because it meant that if you were less well off, you were not condemned to dying early and painfully. So those two concrete things, I think, changed for all time and for the better.
Mm.
But no, as well, in that we still in the UK have an enormous problem that, you know, the kind of family that you're born into is more of a determinant of how you're going to end up than how hard you try.
In the author's note, you explain that your grandparents' lives inspired this story. At the end of the book, did you feel that you had inhabited your grandparents' lives?
I felt that they'd begun to inhabit mine. Ah. No, I had never thought for very long about my history, my roots, where I come from. I hadn't really thought of myself as being someone who came from somewhere or something or had a tradition behind them. And as I began to spend time in my grandparents' lives, you know, for example, I had 1,000 pages of letters that they had written to each other during the war. Slowly, by a kind of osmosis, they came to haunt me. And I began to ask myself questions like, well, what would my grandmother do in this situation? You know, what would my grandfather say about this? And so they became voices that became allied to mine.
Finally, I love the way you use the language of war to bring together the lovers and achieve peace in the end, if that isn't a giveaway. I hope that's not a spoiler alert, but just...
I think that's grand.
I don't
want to make people miserable. I mean, it's a war story in the realist mode, but that doesn't mean it all has to be tragic, because some extraordinary things did come out of that time as well.
And there was another passage I read which made me wonder if you also write poetry. It has to do with your vivid descriptions of Malta, Alistair's reflection on the hard planes and the hard tanks had come with hard men in hard formations, bringing their boots in adamant time. Do you write poetry?
I try to write prose that isn't too dull.
Okay.
I think that if you look at something as brutal and violent as war, you can't capture battle, I think, in a novel. And a person like me who hasn't been to war can't possibly understand what it's like. And therefore, what can a novel do? A novel can reflect deeply on conversations that the author has had with people who have been in battle. So this is what I did. I interviewed a lot of veterans, a lot of people who'd been through it. And I tried to pick up on the sense of awe that I had in talking to them. How big, how unimaginable for someone like me was what they had been through. And I tried to find a register of speech that would capture it. And often that means looking for words that contrast with each other in unusual ways, that wake you up out of your stupor, because the TV, the news, it normalizes violence, it normalizes war. We become used to it, we become inured to it. And so I had to find a register of prose that made it shocking again.